from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of Spotlight 2010.
I'll find out about Canson art paper.
And I'll find out how Freetown Village is celebrating Mother's Day and baseball season. Plus, there's our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. For 15 years, Indianapolis artists have come together to perform on one night for one reason, HIV/AIDS research and care. David Hochoy and Rob McPherson conceived of the event and have produced it together since 1995, and Rob stole away from his spotlight duties to talk with Sharon.
So, 15 years flew by.
15
fast,
years.
Didn't it?
Yep.
Get in the Wayback Machine. We'll go with you. Take us back to how Spotlight was invented.
Well, David Hochoy and I, and actually a few others, Libby Apple, who was the artistic director of the Indiana Repertory Theater at the time, good friend, Tom Alvarez, we were concerned that the arts community back in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, wasn't doing anything in the HIV/AIDS arena. Going back in time, you remember, it was a scary, dreadful, horrible time where people were dying quickly and not a lot was known about the disease. Mm-hmm. So we actually were losing friends locally as well as across the country, a lot of them in the arts community, and
sure,
we felt we needed to do something. And so we did. We got together some of our pals and, like, you know, Shirley Temple, let's put on a show. And it was it was great fun, and we haven't turned back.
Were there, I'm just curious, were there other ideas for how to raise money that got left behind that you said, this might work, but this is better?
I can't remember that, Sharon. I think it was such an automatic thing. David and I started talking to our colleagues in the arts community, and they said, of course, yes, let's get together. Of course, we should be doing something. Mm-hmm. And it happened so quickly and so positively that I don't even know if we considered anything else, to tell you the truth, because it was such a fun, if you can put that word to it, even during a devastating time, a fun thing for us to do in order to remember our friends and to raise some money.
Absolutely. And I remember the enthusiasm and the think big ethic that was around this. Do you remember what the first spotlight raised and about ballpark where we are today?
It was about, I think it was about $14,000,
yeah,
which we were thrilled with.
Sure.
We were like, David and I were like, wow, we raised over $10,000.
Yeah.
And at that point, the Damien Center was our sole recipient. So we were thrilled to be able to make a $14,000 contribution to the Damien Center. Now, we've had this 15-year partnership with the Indiana AIDS Fund. We will raise anywhere between $250,000 to $400,000 this year alone.
That's astonishing. What percent of that is ticket sales?
Well, a smaller percent. We are very fortunate that the Indiana AIDS Fund and the Health Foundation of Greater Indianapolis has put a lot of volunteer power behind this right now. So a vast majority of our contributions are coming from sponsorships,
mm-hmm,
like a lot of fundraisers out in the community right now. But a good number, I'd say, you know, $80,000 might come from ticket sales. So getting people out is really important.
Absolutely. And there are two price points which is very interesting this year, and there's a reason for them. They are?
Right. It's $15. There's 15 organizations. Actually, there's a few more, but we're saying $15 for 15 performances, so it's a dollar a piece, or $115. And that $115 ticket is for the patron price, and there's a party beforehand and a party with the artists afterwards. And it's all because we're 15 years old this year.
Sure, that makes sense. Now, my sense over the years is that people are very generous. Clues Hall donates the use of the space,
yes,
which is a not inconsiderable expense because you're talking about union stagehands and so forth,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have found, and this was from the very beginning, David and I don't want to say insisted, but the whole premise of this was we weren't going to pay anybody anything, the performers. So all of the musicians, and many of them belong to the local musicians union,
mm-hmm.
all of the stage workers who are union and belong to the local IATSE chapter, Clues Memorial Hall as a huge partner, and thanks to Elise Cushigan there and Butler University and President Bobby Fong, all are behind this. So none of the artists get paid. It's Monday night, which is a weird night for a fundraiser, but it's most everybody's night off. So it's 100% volunteer, and it is the way that we can put you know, our effort and our talents and our contributions back to the HIV/AIDS arena.
And what is the money used for?
All of the money goes to the Indiana AIDS Fund, and it goes directly in, 100% of it goes directly into their grant-making program, and they supply programmatic grants in education, prevention, and awareness in the HIV/AIDS area to organizations throughout the state, and the vast majority of the money raised at Spotlight stays at the local Central Indiana programs that raise that for that serve people with HIV and AIDS.
Sure. So some of the grants are providing care. But many of those dollars are providing education for prevention.
Right. It's education, prevention, and a lot of testing also. You know, we say all the time this is 100% preventable disease. And a lot of it is just awareness, education, smart decisions, testing, knowing your status, knowing your partner's status. And so the more we can get the word out and really maintain and elevate the conversation around the disease is still critical and is still horrible, but it's all around decisions and being smart and being educated. So we're also trying to raise, you know, even though this stays local in our country and in our city, thank goodness it's more of a manageable disease now, Sharon. We're also trying to raise awareness that it's a worldwide crisis.
Right.
You know, here in the United States and in developed countries, we're able to manage it as a chronic disease almost, but there are people, thousands and tens of thousands of people dying daily in Africa and so on. That's very well known, but we need to maintain a focus on that worldwide awareness too.
Absolutely, and sometimes I think people think we're nearly three decades after the first headline in the United States, and 30 years is a long time, but that doesn't mean everybody knows
right,
yet.
Right, and when it becomes somewhat manageable and less of a crisis, I think people's guard comes down a little bit, and the younger generations coming up have always, you know, 20-year-olds have basically in their adult life just thought of it as a manageable disease,
right.
And they need to know that it is a horrible thing.
Yeah, absolutely. My sense is you might even have to turn some performers away at this point. Is that true?
We do have.
And how do you do that?
You know, it speaks to the generosity of this community, I think. We have, every year that we do this, we have more and more either individual artists or groups that approach David and say, hey, can we be in Spotlight next year? And, you know, we could have a four-hour-long performance if we wanted to, but we try to keep it, you know, we use this at the evening as kind of like a performing arts showcase.
Yeah.
3 minutes, 5 minutes, 6 minutes of a taste of, you know, the symphony, the opera, a couple of theaters, a number of dance companies. So if you want to sample the performing arts community, this is the night to do that. But, you know, we do have to be somewhat selective. This is mostly the professional, I would say, performing arts community coming together. There are a number of volunteer organizations as well, but ones that have a very strong history and strong artistic quality too. So it is a great, great night.
Do most of the performers choose something from an upcoming performance so that people get a little sneak preview, or is it more of a, here's something that's just a representative sample of who we are and what we do, or is it a mix?
I think it's a little bit of both. They tell us what they're going to do. There isn't any choosing and picking and, hey, can you sing this or
there's no forced theme for the evening or anything.
Right. And because there's a lack of rehearsal time and to put the whole show together, the amazing crew and backstage technicians put it all together the afternoon of the performance. People come in for 20-minute rehearsal times, and we set lights and mic balances and how we're going to get from one act to the other. So we put the show together from like 11:30 in the morning till about 6:30 in the evening, and then curtains at 7:30. So it's an amazing thing. So
thank goodness you only do it once a year, though, because I know backstage is nuts.
It is nuts, but it's also really, really exciting. It's a lot of fun, and that's actually the energy we get from that. And the whole thing is, even though we all work in the same community and see each other frequently, we're never all together at once. So the performing arts community looks at this as almost like an annual reunion of sorts, and it's very exciting. Lots of hugging and high fives, and you were great in the last show when I saw you. So there is a great camaraderie again, and wonderful collaborative spirit, and really backstage is the place to be that night.
At this point, do you still need volunteers?
We could use volunteers, mm-hmm. Sure. There's over 200 performers, so getting them fed and on and off the stage.
Like herding cats.
Yeah, exactly. Sure, we could definitely use volunteers.
Spotlight has a great profile in this community. I'd be very surprised if you and David, one or both of you, haven't been bombarded with emails and phone calls from people in other communities saying, hey, we want to do that. Can you give us a roadmap? Is there anything else like this that people put together in other cities that you're aware of?
Yeah, not that we're aware of. We have had a lot of calls, and I think sometimes I've mentioned this before. This is a very generous community, generous of spirit, generous in philanthropy, all of those sort of things. The arts community in particular is also incredibly, incredibly collaborative. David is a huge leader in that. But a number of other cities that have talked to us have said, I can't imagine all the arts organizations in our city working together so in such a generous partnership way that we could pull something like this off. Somebody would want to be positioned and be, the top of
Act
Two and the star and want 8 minutes versus the 4 minutes that we allow. And, there are none of those issues here. Everybody is so incredibly supportive of the other and the true purpose of all of this, that it truly is an amazing feat. Sometimes I think we take it for granted. I hope we don't too much. But when we do get those calls nationally and start talking about our wonderful arts community here and how easy it is truly for us to do this, they find it somewhat challenging.
As a producer, what's your favorite moment each year?
My favorite moment is each year is, David is much more of the visible producer than I am. I help with more of the administrative things and work with the Indiana AIDS Fund on some of the fundraising aspects of it all. So, and even though I don't like being on stage at all, one of my favorite moment of the whole night is when we are able to, David and I lead the group curtain call at the end, where all 200 of the performers come back at the end and take one big bow, and David and I have the proud moment of being able to lead a lot of those people by the hand back onto the stage for a final curtain call. And it's a lot of work, and it really pays off at that moment.
Rob McPherson of Spotlight 2010. You can attend Spotlight on Monday, May 10th at Clues Memorial Hall of Butler University. In honor of the event's 15th anniversary, tickets are $15 and then VIP at $115. Proceeds benefit the Indiana AIDS Fund. Visit Spotlight Indy for more information. Again, spotlightindy.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Since 1557, Canson has been inventing and producing high-quality paper for artists, including Picasso, Matisse, and Warhol. Representatives from Canson Paper were in Indianapolis recently for the National Art Materials Trade Association conference. Travis DiNicola took advantage of this opportunity to chat with Robert Toth, Vice President of Marketing for Canson.
Robert, welcome to Art of the Matter and welcome to Indianapolis.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me here.
I must say that I was really intrigued when I heard about Canson, this paper company that's been around forever. 1557, is that correct?
1557 in its current location. The legend is actually that the Montgolfier who started the mill was actually in the Second Crusade, was in jail, and basically learned the trade. And then when the Crusade was over and he was set free, he came back to France and then made paper in certain regions within France. But there was wars going on in Europe and in France, so he moved around for almost 400 years before he got to his current location in Annonay, France, in 1557.
Wow. So you're talking, I mean, a history that could be like 1,000 years almost or something, it seems.
Really. The person really had brought paper making back, you know, to Europe.
Well, you know, I'm going to ask you to give me some history here because I certainly need a history in papermaking. I'm fascinated by this. But before we get to that, I do want to just explain that part of the reason that we're chatting is because you're in town for the National Art Materials Trade Association Conference, which is taking place in Indianapolis as we're recording this. And that's a pretty big deal as well. I mean, it's sort of the big trade association for papermakers, correct?
For art supplies.
Art supplies.
Art supplies, not just paper.
Okay.
So paint and other art supplies.
Well, again, welcome to Indianapolis.
Well, thank you.
And this provided us the opportunity to sit down and chat about Canson paper. So let's start. Tell me more about this history of it. And you said that bringing papermaking back to Europe.
To Europe, actually.
Okay. So, you know, when we look at sort of the history of paper, we think of, certainly of, you know, parchment and the medieval ages and, you know, monks and candles and calligraphy and all that. When was that transition made from parchment to paper, or how did that happen?
Well, actually, they were paper making and using parchment coexisted for a number of years because the parchment had a lot of translucent. It was very translucent. The paper was mainly used by monks and mainly used by people for your fancy writing,
mm-hmm.
books and things.
And then it's I would imagine it had to be very expensive at the time.
It was very expensive and very hard to come by, and only a few people had it. So as papermaking evolved,
mm-hmm.
Then it kind of opened it up to the masses.
Was it something that was it like a guarded secret at any point as far as how to make the paper? Or?
Well, I mean, it goes back to China. Mm-hmm. Everybody, you know, most history says that papermaking was invented in China. From China, it then moved to the Middle East. And then again, during the Second Crusade, when they were making paper, the people held, the Montgolfier was held in as a prisoner there. His trade was to make paper. That's where he learned how to make it.
Then how do we make the jump from France to South Hadley, Massachusetts?
Well, can't
and now I know that's a pretty big jump, but because you haven't been in Western Massachusetts for the past 500 years or so.
No. But Canson has been exports about 120 countries worldwide,
mm-hmm.
and has exported, started exporting into Egypt and into the Middle East. And then came to the U.S. I'm not exactly sure when they came to mm-hmm. the U.S., but they had an office in New York City in the early 1900s. So that's basically when it started.
Looking back at your history, one of the things that I read about earlier that I was most fascinated by was that Canson paper has been used by artists like Picasso and Matisse, and more recently Warhol. I mean, three of my absolute favorites. Tell me about that. I mean, it must be good paper, I guess, or at least it lasts long.
Well, yes, I'll try to be modest, but Canson is the number one art paper manufacturer in the world,
mm-hmm.
And it's. It dedicates itself just to the manufacturing of art paper. There are other people who make art paper, but they don't dedicate their full production to it. And Canson does dedicate itself to the production of art paper. The development of art papers today, as well as in the past, is in conjunction with artists. we're paper makers,
mm-hmm.
but how artists use our papers, we use artists so that artists, we can get the little nuances of paper, even simple things like how the lead comes off a pencil and on with the paper, how well the paper erases, and then for the different medias, whether it's a wet media or a dry media. Currently, you have all kinds of markers, and so the paper has to evolve. Our paper has to evolve with the media available at the time.
So there is certainly, it's very easy to say there is a science that's connected to this art.
I would say it's probably 50 science and 50% art.
Now, what do you know about the history of, I mean, let's say, you know, a Matisse who worked with Canson paper, do you know, I mean, was it, did he work directly with the paper makers? Was it just what he chose because he knew it was the right type of paper to work with, or?
Well, Matisse, I think in with Matisse's case, Matisse did a lot of collage work, as you know. And so he would use various papers, cut them out. He may take tracing paper, which Canson invented tracing paper, and then color the tracing paper, cut it out, and put it on a base paper, which was a Canson paper also.
Okay.
Degas did the same thing. You can see Degas' pastels.
Yes.
Canson is very well known for pastel papers. And Degas used pastel papers as well as tracing papers. So they worked with demand products from the mill, and the mill could make adjustments there.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of, you know, different Matisse exhibits I've gone to where I've just, you know, been in such awe of, especially, you know, his cutouts, and it's amazing. I don't know if I ever consciously thought about where did the paper come from, I guess. And I'm embarrassed to say that.
Right.
You know, that obviously there was a choice not just in what he was cutting in terms of the shapes, but what he was cutting in terms of the paper. Just, I mean, sort of a fascinating thought of, you know, how important those tools are to an artist. And it's often easier, I think, we think about, you know, the quality of the paint that an artist is using, you know, or even just whether it's, you know, acrylic or oil. But the paper itself. Tell me more about how, sort of maybe your knowledge of how the paper has been used by different artists.
Well, one thing that an artist would demand is if he's going to spend all that time making a piece of art, he would demand that the paper can last a long time. So the paper, we use the term archival now, so that the paper is acid-free, free of any impurities that would deteriorate the fibers over time. So that's a critical criteria.
Now, is that a pretty new criteria, though? I mean, in the past 20, 30 years, to hear about archival acid-free paper, or is that something that, I mean, even...
Longevity has always been an issue. And, in fact, probably longevity was easier to obtain years ago than it is today. The waters were cleaner the 200 years ago than they are now. The ability to get raw materials, they used to use rags for making paper. And you could get rags that didn't have elastics in them, and we can't use rags now because you don't know what kind of impurities are in them. But archival longevity has always been an issue, and that has in preparing the pulp when you're making paper to make sure the fibers are very, very long. That's always a critical issue. Then moving from handmade paper into machine-made paper, there are benefits and negatives to that. But so that they had to have different things going on in the paper machine. Paper machines evolved, you know, after it started with handmade paper and evolved there. So longevity has always been an issue. But other issues, Canson invented colored paper, the ability to put color into paper and have that color be maintained. It was also
so that it wouldn't fade over time.
So that it wouldn't fade over time, and that when you worked on it, it wouldn't come off. So in the case of, say, a Degas, somebody who was working with pastels, different colored paper he would use as basically the foundation for his work. So Canson is probably best known now to artists for its colored pastel papers.
And also, I've read about some of your marble papers as well.
The paper, Canson doesn't make marble paper. Marble papers are made from a base paper.
Okay.
And Canson makes base papers that were used in marbling.
Tell me a bit about how Andy Warhol, known for his great silkscreen prints, used your papers.
Well, Andy Warhol, when doing printmaking, Canson has basically two mills at this point, Canson and the Arche Paper Mill. And the Arche Paper Mill is makes professional printmaking papers and is extremely well known. You can go to any university with a printmaking department and you will find mm-hmm. our papers. So he probably, as a student, probably trained with these papers. So it was an obvious choice when he was actually, you know, doing his professional work.
Sure, sure. Bob, tell me a little bit more about why specifically you're here at this conference here in Indianapolis.
Well, we're here because it's our national annual convention, but what's exciting for us is that it is the end of a three-year-long process of which we have done interviews with college professors, with art students, to understand the changes in their needs, and we have redone our paper line. We have made adjustments to it to basically so that it can evolve to so it can it basically take care of the needs of today's artists.
Wow. Okay.
There's lots of new media that are mm-hmm. available today, which means that the demands on paper have evolved. And it's quite an interesting process because you have to maintain what you have
mm-hmm.
and when add to that.
Any of the papers, are they used in any way for example, work that's being done, you know, through computer printers or copiers where artists are using, you know, those as tools as well?
Yes, we actually have a line of inkjet, of professional inkjet okay. papers. And what these papers are same base papers, our same well-known printmaking papers, watercolor mm-hmm. papers, then they are coded to be digitally printed. So an artist can do his original work on one of our watercolor papers or our printmaking papers or our pastel papers, and then if he wants to print, he can print digitally on these products.
And again,
have the same paper, the same look, same texture, same colors.
And this has all been in response to, it sounds like, sort of focus groups you've been doing with the artists and students who've been using your papers.
That's part of it, because the paper is continuously evolving, the demands on paper. I mean, Canson at one time made photographic paper. When people were using platinum to print,
mm-hmm.
Canson then developed the product of a positive and negative paper for doing photo printing and eliminate the need for platinum. Now, what's interesting in that case is just last week I was talking to a traditional platinum paper,
mm-hmm.
and now we're basically reinventing the paper that we had eliminated maybe 150 years ago.
And everything old is new again.
Right. So basically developing an original platinum paper. So things are always evolving, but we're very conscious of our history and of our past because techniques have maintained over the years.
Now, you mentioned earlier some sort of historic first for the company, first tracing paper. What's this about the world's first hot air balloon? utilized
Well, I mentioned
paper.
The McGauffier family, the mm-hmm. members of the family.
And say the name for me again, McGauffier.
Okay. Now, non-artists will know the McGauffier for the hot air balloon. The mm-hmm. original hot air balloon was called the McGauffier. It was launched in 1782 in Annonay, France, and then in 1783 in Versailles with Louis the 16th.
And so it was used, the paper was the show? Then.
Yeah, it was Etienne and Joseph Montgolfier.
Huh.
Basically, it's aerostatic, and I'm not an engineer by any mm-hmm. means, but it's you create static in the air, and it blows inside the balloon.
Yeah.
And which is interesting is that during that time, Benjamin Franklin was coming to Versailles quite often as they were trying to work a deal, I guess, to get partnership for the revolution.
Right.
And he was good friends with Etienne Montgolfier because of their interest in this static, aerostatic.
Wow. Very neat. Now, today, you mentioned that certainly there's a big difference between making paper by hand as opposed by machine. I would assume most of it is made by machine. Is there still some paper that's made by hand?
There are still paper manufacturers that do it by hand. But most paper manufacturing is turned to machines, and there's different kinds of machines. In making art paper, though, it's really the pulping process, the pre-machine process, is just really critical to eliminate any kind of impurities in the fiber, to be able to stretch the fibers, to make them long and strong. Basically, you take a fiber and you kind of rub it so that.
And when you say a fiber, I mean like a
could be
cotton,
or it could be wood.
Okay, so cotton or wood, and tell me a little bit. I'm very curious about. I mean, just for the details of how that happens. You take that raw material and you said you pulp it up.
It becomes pulp. Putting some kind of cellulose, whether it's cotton or whether it's wood,
mm-hmm.
into water. It just starts the pulping
yeah.
process. but you want to separate the fibers.
Mm-hmm.
So the refining process pre-machine is very, very important. It's not so important for, say, a Xerox copy paper.
Sure.
But it's very important for art papers for the strength and for longevity. At that time, you also add other agents, could be coloring agents if you're making colored paper, or you add a substance called sizing. And sizing is something that determines how paper and water react together.
Now, let me ask you about the line of children's products that that Canson's been coming out with. I know that in a few weeks we'll have another interview with Sharon Gamble. My co-host is going to be talking with Giulio Giovanelli about the Eric Carlisle line. Eric Carlisle, the children's author-illustrator. These are... recycled papers, acid-free?
The product line is mainly a recycled product mm-hmm. line. So basically, it's the first recycled art paper for children. It's a very exciting project. We're fortunate in that Eric Carle is near our headquarters in Massachusetts. And Eric Carle does a technique much like Matisse did, where he would color vellum papers, mm-hmm. what we call vellum is tracing paper, would color those papers and then cut them out. So normally, we work with a specific artist that has certain techniques.
Like a Hungry Caterpillar, related. Right?
Exactly. So yeah. It was kind of a perfect relationship because of the way he did his art mm-hmm. on papers like ours. And so it made sense for us to work with him to develop this range.
Travis DiNicola with Robert Toth, Vice President of Marketing for Canson, an art paper company. For more information about Canson, visit canson-us.com. That's canson-us.com. And later this summer, you'll hear my conversation with Canson's product manager, Giulia Giovanelli. Hey, Travis, what's that hanging outside the door to the studio on the doorknob? It's a May Day basket.
Oh, of course it is. Yeah. Right. That's absolutely
we grew up in different parts of the country. That accounts for it. we have our own version of a little present for you on our calendar.
Oh, I love May Day basket that we call
What do we do?
Oh, that's just
for
adorable.
For May Day.
Hey, opening next week at the Phoenix Theater. It's not a play, actually. It's more of a sort of a concert using music to tell a story but without dialogue. And it's all John Prine. It is pure Prine, the music of John Prine. If you're a fan of John Prine, as many of us are, especially here in Indianapolis, then you're going to love this performance. It features a lot of great local musicians like Tim Brickley, Tim Grimm, Michael Shelton, Bobby Lancaster, Jan Lucas, Jenny Gregory, and they're going to be playing music from the past 30 years of John Prine and putting it together in a really cool story. This opens next weekend and runs through the 16th for 7 performances at the Phoenix. Can't wait for this one.
A lot of fun. Speaking of things that are special, the Decorators Show House is going on right now. And they're doing a series of programs, breakfast, lunches, twilight tours, so on and so forth. But I want to pay special heed to one called Living with History Then and Now. Many of us probably have that famous coffee table book called Indianapolis Then and Now. It's part of a series of historic photos of great cities around the country. And the event is from 8:30 to 10 on Friday, May 7th, and it is a breakfast that will feature Joan Hostetler, who is a photo historian, basically, and she was involved with the creation of the Then and Now book. You can learn about the Tarkington era and see a presentation of the historic neighborhood before you go on the Decorator Show House tour. And local author Nelson Price, who is a big fan of Indianapolis history, will be part of that program as well. You can find out all about that at showhouseindy.org, and again, that's a breakfast coming up on Friday, May 7th.
Something you mentioned next Friday night on the 7th, that's also first Friday night, so a lot of galleries are going to be open. This show just sounds amazing to me. It's taking place down at Big Car. They're always doing something mm-hmm. interesting at Big Car down in Fountain Square. This one's titled Replanting the Garden, and Big Car is bringing in New York artist and curator Richard Saja, and he is creating a piece called Replanting the Garden that brings together the works of over 40 different artists from all over the country who were given the same directive to create a piece in response to Hieronymus Bosch,
Hieronymus, easy for me to say, Hieronymus Bosch's greatest work, The Garden of Earthly Delights.
Oh,
if
my
you
gosh.
Know that piece, I mean, you know how crazy and amazing
dark,
it
creepy,
is.
Oh, yeah. Fascinating.
So you've got 40 artists who are sort of responding to it, interpreting it, and it's all part of the show Replanting the Garden at Big Car Gallery. Opens at 6 p.m. from 6 to 11 next Friday night down in Fountain Square in the Murphy Building.
Boy, I hope there's a glass of wine to be had along with that. It sounds
a couple.
Yeah, exactly.
And a medic on hand.
Speaking of art, the Indiana State Museum is opening an exhibit on May 1st called Heartland Art Selections from Your Indiana Art Collection. It features 45 paintings, easy for me to say. I can say Hieronymus Bosch, but I can't say 45. And 5 pieces of sculpture from the collection of the Indiana State Museum. Again, it opens May 1st and runs through February 11th of 2011. So all sorts of, some of the finest Indiana art from the Indiana State Museum.
And we will be back next week with more creative things to do and some creative pronunciations
on
What'll
We
Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Don't tell her history teachers, but Ophelia Wellington, executive director of Freetown Village, loves history. Oh, no, not the way it used to be taught in schools, but the way history can be experienced in a living, breathing recreation that invites conversation and inquiry. Ophelia dropped by to talk with Sharon Gamble about 3 upcoming Freetown Village programs, the second annual Mother-Daughter Tea, the vintage baseball season, and summer camp.
Ophelia, you and I are old enough to remember when people dressed up for Mother's Day, and if your mother was with you, you had you probably did something just with a mother and daughter, and I love the mother-daughter tea. How did the idea of putting this together come up when you first put it together last year?
Well, this is our second year for the mother-daughter tea, and I had gone downtown to the Tea Cozy for a tea.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the food was served, the tea was served, it kind of reminded me of the old days when we used china and we washed dishes by hand.
Mm-hmm.
And on Mother's Day, we dressed up. We wore dresses to church. We wore hats and we wore gloves. And if our mom was alive, we wore a red rose or a carnation.
Mm-hmm.
And usually by May, our roses had bloomed in our yard, so we would always get a fresh carnation to wear. If your mom was deceased, you wore a white rose or a white carnation.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the same thing for Father's Day in terms of the flowers.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a time in our past where it was fun. It was a tradition. It was something to do. It was something to celebrate. And so I thought, why don't we do that? And that's what we're doing, a mother-daughter tea for women to come, dress it as you like. Many of the women last year wore hats. And now we don't wear hats on a regular basis, but for a special occasion, it was fun. Some women actually went out and bought a hat. It gave them an excuse to wear one. Then there was many who came without a hat and didn't feel like they needed to wear a hat, and
sure,
we're not saying hats are required. But we had contests on mother and daughter look-alike, and what was so interesting, Sharon, is that most of the women that came with their daughters wanted to enter the contest. And it was like, okay, now who's going to judge? So I think we're thinking another way of how we're going to judge. If everyone wants to be part of the contest, who's going to be the judge? But it was just a fun time of tea conversations, and we played some games around tea and some of the nostalgic games of Mama Said and daughter relationships. So it was just a special time.
You know, what's interesting to me is that I don't remember, and maybe you do, when this particular tradition died out. But I am old enough to remember when I used to sew as a child, because my mother sewed and her mother sewed, and you were taught to sew in school. And I distinctly remember an era when having a mother-daughter matching outfit of some sort for a special occasion, maybe Christmas, maybe Easter, maybe Mother's Day, that was a cool thing. And I don't know what happened to that. I most of the mothers and daughters I know would never be caught wearing anything similar nowadays. But, I was at a meeting of arts administrators the other day when you mentioned the white rose, red rose, or white carnation, red carnation, and everybody in the room pretended to be too young to remember that, but I'm here to say I remember that. I've done it even fairly recently, just so people will say, why are you wearing a white carnation?
Well, that's true. We had a volunteer, an older lady who was working with us, and she made, our bouquets and corsages.
Mm-hmm.
And she came in and she gave us all a corsage. And it was such a special thing because for years I hadn't worn anything. But since she made that and gave it to us, every Mother's Day I wear the white corsage.
Mm.
And it was just a special remembrance. Okay, we need to bring these things back. And some people don't know, or like you say, they pretend they don't know.
Yeah.
And then I begin to think, okay, was this more regional than what I recall? Because I know where I grew up, and I grew up in St. Louis, we all did that. So maybe people in Indianapolis, it wasn't a big deal to them. But no one came to church without a corsage that I can recall. As a child,
right,
from a child's perspective, I cannot remember anyone not wearing a corsage.
Right. It was it's part of a series of etiquette traditions, cultural traditions that served as a kind of a code, and we've lost some of those. We've lost some of those traditions.
And that's what we do in Freetown Village. We try to recreate some of the historical traditions, give it some meaning for people who don't know, and make it fun. Not like this is a lecture. We're going to sit you down and make
right.
you understand why we did these things those years. But it's to make things memorable, and if you want to do it now, fine, but at least you know and you have the opportunity to choose to do it or not. But with the mother-daughter tea, another thing we're doing is the vintage baseball. We play baseball with old-fashioned rules of it was a gentleman's game of sport where you didn't spit on the ground, you couldn't curse with the umpire. You could not steal bases. So it was a different time that men play sports. And even today when we see fights on the field and fights on the ice and fights, you're thinking, these are grown people acting like little children. I can understand them getting all piped up and everything, but to haul off and bust somebody upside the head because you're angry with them, it's not a very adult thing to do.
No, and it completely fights the image of a gentleman's game.
Yes.
And of sportsmanship,
right.
Whether they're men or women, although in the era you're creating, it's just men. The Freetown Village Maroons will be playing. And this is a game, it goes back a ways. This goes back to the Revolutionary War earlier, maybe?
Well, the baseball, and it was spelled with two words, base and ball, did start during that time. The rules have evolved over the years, and we play by the 1860s rules, and that's what I was referencing. You could catch a ball on a bounce. You could tell the hurler, which is what we call the pitcher, where you wanted your balls, what level you wanted your balls pitched to you.
Really?
And if the hurler did not throw it at the level you wanted, you could just stand there and it could just go by, and it was not called a strike because
really?
The hurler did not throw it to you the way you want it thrown.
Boy, so, that's a big change.
Well, then, I was listening the other day. I think it was a Cardinals game. They went into maybe, I forgot how many innings, 20 innings maybe. It was a really long game. And I think, okay, some of these rules were instituted to shorten the game so that people can get on with their business. But to have a game and you're sitting there and you And the game is tied for an hour, is tied for another hour, is tied and tied and tied. It's like, we need to go home. Now, who's in the stands?
I do know people who take novels to Indians games for that exact reason. The umpire had, we were talking about wearing hats a minute ago, the umpire in the game as it would was played in the way you're recreating it had a special kind of hat, which was?
He wore a top hat. As a gentleman, he dressed in a top hat with, what do you call that? It's not the morning coat, but it's a frock coat. Typically a frock coat.
Cool.
But, again, it was a gentleman. Yeah. And he would have a vest on and his watch pocket and watch in his pocket. And you would come out there and you didn't roll around in the dirt because you wouldn't slide to steal a base. You could leave there and just wash your face off and go wherever you were going to go because you were clean.
I love that. I love that. You have a summer camp coming up as well.
We do. We have a summer camp. It's for children ages 5 through 14 years old. And we have that. It's a 9-week summer camp. It's on the east side of town at St. Albans on 46 and Emerson. And we've been doing the camp now probably 12, 15 years. It's a great time for children to learn about history, to be in small groups where they're taught. They do a lot of hands-on things. They make butter. They make homemade ice cream. Sometimes they make quilts. So when we were talking about sewing, a lot of children today have never in their life threaded a needle, let alone stitched anything. So for us, we're having to show them how to thread a needle, how to hold it so you can tie a knot in the end of it, and how to hold a needle in one hand and the fabric in the other hand and make those two work together. It is hilarious to see the beginning angst the children have trying to figure out how to manipulate two different things, holding something and then sewing with the other hand. But
it's one of the few things that hasn't been computerized. I don't think there's a Wii sewing game or frankly, you know, unless there's some field of technology you and I don't know about, I don't think there's ever going to be an app for somebody's iPhone that sews a button on his or her shirt.
But you know, they glue them on now, or they there's this thing that just kind of is a plastic thing that kind of hole punches buttons in place.
So, and that's not good.
That's where things are moving today. And people throw things away.
Yeah.
So if you have a button that's missing, you can't find it, you just throw it away and get something else. You have a hole in your sock, you throw it away. As people don't repair things like they used to repair things. So our society has changed. But there's nothing wrong with trying to at least helping to educate people about the past and teaching them some of the values that we've had.
And, you know, you're still a young woman, but you had the idea to start Freetown Village back in the early 80s. Was there a kind of an incident or an experience that made you say, that does it, I'm taking the leap, I'm starting a not-for-profit to educate people, to preserve some traditions, to preserve some of our cultural knowledge? Was there one aha moment where you said, I have to do this?
I used to teach school. I did not teach history. That was not a favorite subject of mine. In fact, I dislike history so much.
Really?
But
why?
It was
dry.
It was very dry. Things that we learned in history, I saw no value in because there were things about the past. I couldn't relate to anything that I learned in history. So I found it as useless information. But I taught English and language arts and journalism and things of that nature. But when I was actually reading the Old Testament of the Bible, and at that point I began to understand the importance of history. If you understand the Old Testament, then the New Testament makes a little bit more sense because you can see what happened then and what's happening later in the New Testament. And all of the history of the people of Israel and how God had led them. And I thought about our people, how a lot of us don't know our history. And if you don't know your history, then you kind of don't understand who you are, your purpose in life, and your strengths, and what you can do, and some of the people in the past. So I thought, what's a good way of teaching people history? So I pulled on my knowledge as a classroom teacher. And when I was teaching students and we were dealing with subjects, things that I didn't think they would be interested in or would be difficult to explain, I turned it around and made it more hands-on, more opportunities for them to be engaged, for them to ask questions, to learn it from their perspective. So that's why I kind of took the history and said, well, if I was to teach people about African-American history, what would I do? And I thought, if I put on a costume and I had some information I could talk about the history and I could engage people in and allow them to do things and ask me questions about things that they were particularly interested in, and if I had that knowledge, I can at least guide them for more information. And then my research would be guided by the kinds of questions the people wanted information about. So that's the short story of how and why I started doing this. So all the programs that we do are from that perspective. What's a fun way? I shouldn't say fun because some people think, okay, then it's kind of light. But
it's not an amusement park, but it's not an engaging.
It's an engaging way, an interactive way of teaching. So we teach history, we teach about African-American culture, and it's not exclusive. It shows how our perspective on different things, how we did things, and some people who are non-African-American say, oh, that's just for black people. I said, well, no, it's not. It's American history. But we're also talking about things that most people didn't know about. We're not making it up. These are things that we've researched, we've documented to make sure that we're not fantasizing our history, but we are telling a different story. And many people find it very interesting and engaging, and then they begin to make connections. Okay, now I get it. Now I see why this is that. I understand, and they're making the connections.
Sharon Gamble with Ophelia Wellens, and executive director and founder of Freetown Village. The Mother-Daughter Tea is coming up on Saturday, May 8, from 2 to 4 p.m. at the New Covenant Church, 4625 North Keystone Avenue. Tickets are going fast. You can contact Freetown Village to learn more about the tea, vintage baseball, and the summer camp at 317-631-1870. Again, 631-1870, or visit freetownvillage.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4. I'll find out everything that's new at what used to be the Historic Landmarks Foundation of Indiana. Plus, I'll get to chat with filmmaker Steve Mara.
And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What Do We Do?
So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.